Hi, everyone. I'm joined by Debbie from Australia. And as you guys know, I'm in Canada. So we're on two opposite sides of the world, united with some special magical thing called the internet. And also united by a common, not so common, but somehow common backgrounds. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, Debbie is an ex-Mormon and I'm an ex-Muslim. So we're going to talk about that. We're going to go through Debbie's story. We're going to find out, you know, what her journey was like. As a bit of a background, I ran into Debbie on TikTok. So some of you know I've started a TikTok account now and I'm having lots of fun on there. We might talk about that a bit as well. what type of conversations we've been having. And I found Debbie found me, either way, however it happened, on TikTok. And I'm like, hey, I love your content. I mean, I love the way you put things out and the way you're describing things, and I'd love to talk to you. So here we are having this conversation. How's it going, Debbie?
Yeah, really good.
Awesome. So I'm just going to share her link as well. For those of you who are on TikTok, you can check out Debbie on TikTok there. And just as a heads up, for those of you who don't know, this is a new channel. The main channel is still there, the Abdullah Samir channel. But because I am demonetized, I'm putting all my content on this channel. So hopefully if you're new, meaning old new, you're on the old channel and you just need to resubscribe to this one, and everything will be on here going forward. So now that we have that out of the way, so Debbie, let's go back to the very beginning. Let's talk about, how did this whole thing start for you? Not even that. Let's go back to like your childhood. Like, how was it being raised as a Mormon? I assume your parents are Mormon as well?
They were, yeah. Immigrated to Australia when I was 5, and my parents joined the Mormon church when I was about 6 years old. So they were pretty new to Australia, and I guess some missionaries came, knocked on their door. I was baptized when I was 8, which is normal in the Mormon church. And then shortly after that, my parents were not actually going to church very much. And when I was about 13, someone from church invited me to go to church. And I started attending from then on. And so I was active in the Mormon church for about 30 years before I left. My parents were definitely Mormon. My dad really didn't attend for most of my life. My mother later became quite devout. And but that was later. So for about 15 years, I just attended church by myself. But I think that actually made me more committed to it. Like, I think I bought into it even more because of that. So yeah.
So you were more religious than your parents.
Yeah, for a long time.
Yeah, that's funny, because that happened to me too. My parents were religious, and I kind of converted into it, and I became all gung-ho about it. So did you? So then, what happened after that? So you were an active member of the church for 30 years. You're saying, yeah. I don't know much about Mormonism. I know a little bit. Can you tell us? Because I think a lot of people might get confused between Mormon, Jehovah's Witnesses, and some of the other, you know, like Orthodox, Baptist, and so many groups, eh?
Sure. So Mormonism is just trying to think what's best to say. So, okay, its origins, its founder is a man named Joseph Smith. He claimed to have been visited by God when he prayed about which religion was the true one. And he said that God and Jesus visited him and told him that none of them were correct, and that he should restore the gospel to the earth. Yeah. It kind of goes from there.
There's golden tablets or something he found in his backyard or something like that.
Oh, he supposedly an angel visited him and directed him to some gold plates that had what he translated to be the Book of Mormon.
Yeah.
And
it was Angel Moroni, right?
Moroni.
Moroni or something? Yeah. Moroni, yeah.
Yeah. And so, so it's a fairly, I mean, as religions goes, it's a fairly young religion. We're only talking, you know, the 1800s. What it's like to actually be a Mormon, it's a high demand religion, which means that you are kept very busy. You know, you pray every day, you read your scriptures, you have calling. So, you know, for many years I was a teacher in various capacities, and other various roles. And you're just kind of always thinking about church, about religion, about... and I think that that was... It's a very effective tool. If you can keep people busy every day and sort of have them always have religion in their mind, it's a really good way to keep people involved and not ever thinking about whether this is actually, whether it actually makes any sense. So the busier you can keep people, the better. And I found that to be very true with the Mormon Church. And I'll come back to that when we talk about leaving. I'll mm-hmm. come back to that point. But yeah, I mean, I think most people, they meet Mormons, they think, gosh, they're, you know, they seem like nice people. Generally they are, but it doesn't mean that the doctrines aren't problematic. It doesn't, you know, so I don't know. What other kinds of things do you want to?
So, you know, it's interesting because I find the same thing with Islam, that it has this thing about keeping you busy, right? You're constantly praying five times a day. There's adhkar, meaning adhkar means like remembering God when you wake up, remembering God when you go to sleep. So there's special things you have to say when you wake up. Then before you put on clothes, you have to say something. Before you have sex, you have to say something. Before you go to the toilet, you say something. There's always something to remember God. Like it's so like... It's OCD, to be honest. Like, it's just like, go in the washroom with your right leg, come out with your left leg, go in the mosque. Go in the washroom with your left leg first, eat with your right hand. And all of these rules, not all of them are obligatory, but there's so many rules and so many things you have to do. And it just keeps you very, very busy and distracted, right? I mean, it keeps you distracted. The funny thing is, it's, you know, religion, I mean, some people see it in a way that is, it's all about mindfulness. You know, the prayer is a way to disconnect. I mean, that's how many Muslims would sort of, talk about the prayer. They'll say, well, yeah, I have my busy life, but then I stop and I pray. But the prayer itself is a big distraction from thinking about, you know, the truth, because at least with the Islamic case, the prayer is reading Quran and bowing and bending and sitting. And it's not like really contemplative, if you know what I mean. It's not like you don't have a chance to contemplate. You're not really sitting and thinking or pondering or focusing on your breath and, you know, allowing your mind to be still. It's nothing like that. It's just a lot of things going on. So that would be my sort of criticism of it. But isn't Mormonism known for like multiple polygamy? Is that a thing with Mormonism?
Yeah, that's kind of an interesting thing. So in the early days of the church, they practice polygamy. Not everyone, but, you know, there's no community where everyone can practice polygamy because there aren't enough women to go around.
Oh, yeah.
But certainly Joseph Smith, the founder, in fact, that's kind of an interesting point, because when you grow up in the church, you know, until I was an adult, I was taught that Joseph Smith had one wife, Emma. And I knew that other leaders like Brigham Young, etc., had practiced polygamy. But there was, for some reason, it was never really taught that Joseph Smith had had more than one wife, which is an interesting point, because it has to do with the way he practiced polygamy. When I was maybe in my 20s, I went to a religion class where they told me that he had had more than one wife. But the way they explained it was that, you know, the Mormons were, you know, persecuted in those times, and he married widows to protect them. And, you know, that is complete bullshit. Like, yeah. It's just complete bullshit. He married 9 teenagers. Seven or eight of them he married when he was 37. He married 11 women who were already married to other men, which has never been a doctrine of the Mormon Church. So yeah. I think that this actually is a little bit the Mormon Church's PR spin, right? Though Joseph Smith's practice of polygamy is not faith promoting, so they just don't talk about it. And they're like that with a lot of things. Mm-hmm. So the story that I had growing up, the narrative that I hadn't believed in, is not actually the true story. And that applies to so many things. So, yeah, they did practice polygamy for a while. They stopped that in the very late 1800s, early 1900s, because of laws that were being passed that would end in their prosecution. And to be honest, it's still part of the doctrine. Even though they don't practice it now in terms of legal marriage or civil marriage, men are still, you know, sealed to more than one woman in their temple. And as long as you're not married legally, civilly to them, you know, but if their wife dies, they can marry another. It's considered that in the eternities, they'll have those, both of those wives or however many. So it isn't really a doctrine that's completely gone away, but they don't practice it in terms of civil marriage. So, yeah.
So the kind of working around it, like, sounds like what some Muslims do to work around the ban on polygamy or bigamy. They'll have one wife and then they'll have like a girlfriend on the side who's actually Islamically married to her. So they're still doing it then, basically. They're just not.
Well, they don't in the sense of. So I think they don't do it in that sense, or at least it wouldn't be approved by the church for them to do that.
Okay.
But I think that the relevant point for me is that this thing is still a doctrinal belief. So they still believe that after this life, they'll be married to whoever they've been sealed to. Men, though. Women can't be sealed to more than one. Man, but then when you talk to them, they'll say, "Oh no, I mean, no, gosh, we don't practice polygamy anymore," which is technically true, but it's still part of their doctrine. So it's a little bit dishonest in that sense. And to be honest, if a man is civilly divorced from one woman, he can be sealed to another in the temple. So he can be sealed to two living women.
What does that mean, be sealed?
Sorry, I should have explained. Basically, Mormons believe that in the temple there's authority to marry someone, not just for time, like not just for this life, but for eternity. And they refer to that kind of marriage as sealing. So it's basically joining two people for eternity.
Can you divorce in the Mormon church?
Can you
divorce? Can you break up with your, so even though it's sealed, it's not totally sealed until you die. It's only if you die and it's sealed that you're considered to be with them forever?
Well, actually, if you're divorced from them civilly, you have to separately seek to break that sealing. And I know women who've left the church and the church has refused to get rid of their sealing. So they're still sealed to their Mormon husband in Mormon terms. Yeah.
But I guess it doesn't. So this is only like a dogma thing. This is like a belief that there's no like civil. There's no, what I'm trying to ask is it, there's no civil like effects of being sealed other than like it, you could be actually married.
Oh yeah, no. It's, I mean, when you are sealed in the temple, it counts as civil marriage if you are not yet civilly married. But yeah, no, it's an eternity thing in general.
Yeah, that definitely in some ways mirrors the Islamic thing, because with Islam as well, you have a totally different marriage thing called a nikah. Nikah is an Islamic marriage, and to have a nikah is very easy. You just have to have two witnesses. So you could technically, the same idea, you would get a nikah, but you'd also be married by a registered marriage officer. And so the nikah becomes also civil, right? Just like in a church or whatever. But then the problem is the opposite for breaking the nikah. It's much easier for the man to break the marriage in Islam than it is to get a civil divorce. So to get a civil divorce, you have to be separated in Canada for, I don't know, 6 months or 1 year, and then you apply for it and blah, 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 and you can get it. But in Islam, the man just says talak, which means a divorce, and that is considered an actual divorce. Now, of course, there's a little bit more nuance to it than that. You have to wait 30 days. And if you wait 30 days and you don't make up, then it's considered final. If you do it three times, one after another, after with a 30-day break in between, and eventually it's considered fine. But like, you could end up in a situation where you are divorced Islamically, so you cannot look at your wife cannot look at you, cannot be together alone, all of that, but still Islamically, but still in the civil you're still married in the eyes of the law. So it's kind of this kind of conflict between, you know, this theological marriage versus the civil marriage, right? It's kind of, they don't always line up perfectly. And the same thing with, like, you know, marrying two wives. You can't marry two wives in Canada. So like, I know one imam that does it. He has two houses, two wives, and two sets of kids, one in each house. One of them is his wife, one of them is not. So the one that's not his wife, she doesn't get any sort of benefits. Like, which means that if anything happens, she's not protected. It ends up being a negative situation for her, unfortunately, because she's the second wife. And so she doesn't get all of the, you know, like when you're married to someone, you, of course, when you have kids with someone, there's always child support and all that. But in terms of the actual marriage itself, there's also a sort of legal commitment there, right? And you don't, if you're not married, then the whole asset splitting and all that, I don't even know how it would work. I mean, I think she would get basically nothing, you know? So it's kind of unfortunate this happens.
And I've read, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but also, this example came from a UK situation where couples don't always choose to marry civilly. They'll sometimes just marry in Islam, and then it makes it difficult because a woman doesn't always have the specified right to divorce because she hasn't gotten that kind of arrangement. The book I'm thinking of is, it's not just about the burqa, which was a really excellent, it's written by Muslim women about some of these issues. And I actually recommend that to anyone who wants to not, you know, make assumptions. it was a pretty good book.
Nice. Yeah, I remember hearing the same thing. Actually, I was surprised when I heard about this. I was Muslim for 15 years. I was surprised to hear about this. I was really surprised that there's people out there getting married and not registering their marriage. And I was like, surprise me, but you're right. It does happen. I don't exactly know what the motivation is. I think it's probably a mistrust of the government, and we don't want the government meddling in our affairs. We'll deal with it ourselves. If we have a problem, we'll go to the imam. Our society or whatever, you know, we will deal with it. But it's ridiculous. It's really ridiculous because, like you said, it just means that people's rights are not legally necessarily protected, right? Which is unfortunate. But I don't know how common. I mean, in Canada, I don't think that's common because maybe it is actually. Now that I think about it, I know one person. I think he told me that was the situation. I think he was in Canada. But yeah, that's unfortunate. It's not good.
Yeah.
Not good. So I just want to read this comment. It says, Steffi said, Joseph Smith reminds me of Muhammad. I think that's actually a good example because, I mean, I don't know much about Joseph Smith, but what you just told me, Muhammad had multiple wives as well. I mean, one of them was 6 years old, according to the hadith, which may or may not be true, but according to Sunni Muslims, that's what they believe. She was 6 years old. And the rest of them, you know, some of them were in the teens and like maybe 19, 20. And then, you know, his first wife was very old, not very old, but like double his age approximately. He was in his 20s. She was, I think, in the 40s. So, and at that time, this is before he became a prophet, he was married only to one woman. But then after he became a prophet, he started marrying multiple wives. So, and then he even married a woman that was already married, just like you just told me that, like how he, there's one example of that, which was Zainab. So his cousin, actually, his cousin was married to another man, and he, whatever happened, he fell in love with her for some reason. He liked the look of her, something happened. And then after that incident, she divorced and he just married her. And Muslim scholars even say that he's like, he had the right to marry anyone, even someone that was already married. So most Muslims, I don't think they know, they don't look at it like that. They see it a little bit differently, but it just goes to show you, doesn't it? That like, when you have a God man, that is what happens. And it becomes an abuse of power. And it's not just what Muhammad did himself. It's what he allowed, not Muhammad or Joseph Smith or whatever, it's what they allow the followers, the right-hand men, the close associates, the, you know, the men of the, usually the men of the religion, to perpetrate on others, on women, and on, you know, more vulnerable members of society. And it becomes like theologically justified. So Muhammad allowed his men to take captives of war, slaves, and to sleep with the slaves. And this was all hunky-dory. And even we know that some of the companions were concerned about this. They were like, well, this woman's married. And then the Quran said, no, it's okay, she's your slave, whatever, right? And so here's an example of how religion, you know, justifies the kind of like the worst things, right? And it just makes it,
yeah, you know. And religious authority is used to justify things that in any other situation would not be acceptable. You know, I mean, no Mormon, right? You know, the Mormons I know, they would never agree to that kind of behavior. They were, you know, but somehow because it's Joseph Smith, because they believe he was a prophet, they justify it. They kind of get this cognitive dissonance, and then they figure out how to shelve that information so that they don't have to deal with that unsettling feeling. But also it's commenting, I mean, I will leave any comments about Muhammad to you because I don't know enough to comment. But I know that Joseph Smith is very, he's a good textbook example of a cult leader. You know, the rules that are in the religion don't apply to them. You know, Mormons don't drink alcohol. He certainly did. You know, they... The kind of promiscuity that he, you know, they're not allowed to do that. He was. So it's definitely, I don't know, the more I look at him, the more I just think he really fits the picture of a charismatic cult leader. So, yeah, Mormons are not like that with their current prophet. But, yeah, that history is there.
Current prophet, that's interesting. So how does that, how does that work? How's the, is it like a descendant of?
No. Interestingly,
Joseph Smith, or is it someone that's elected?
There's a breakaway church that's now known as the Community of Christ. And they actually broke away from the main church, and their prophets are descendants of Joseph Smith. But in the case, so the Mormon church has a president who is considered the prophet. He has two counselors, and together they make the first presidency. And then there are 12 men under that who are the apostles. So, you know, they're trying to mimic the structure. Jesus has 12 apostles, etc. Yeah. And then when the prophet dies, whoever is the senior apostle becomes the next prophet. So yeah, and I think honestly it's just because Brigham Young happened to be that senior apostle, and they decided that was, you know, what was meant to be. So yeah,
interesting. Would you agree with this comment that Mormonism is a financial pyramid scheme? I don't know enough about it to comment.
I think that it's pyramid scheme. It's a pyramid scheme in terms of, you know, missionary effort, but
yeah.
I think when it comes to the finances, what I think is definitely true is that it's very corporate.
Okay.
And it really is, the money is important to the church. So, for example, at one time, black men were not allowed to receive the priesthood. Now, sorry, every time I say something, I think they're not going to know what that means. So, in the Mormon Church, the priesthood is held generally by all men from the time that they're 12 years old. And so it's not something that just a priest, a bishop, a pastor holds. It's something that's all men. But until 1978, black men were banned from receiving the priesthood. And you'd think, in 1978, the prophet at that time, Spencer Kimball, announced that, revelation from God, and now they, would be able to have the priesthood. But interestingly, it coincided with a couple of events. One is that, of course, the civil rights movement had occurred, and BYU, there were colleges that were refusing to play sport against BYU, which is Brigham Young University, which is owned by the church,
Okay.
on the basis that their church had racist policies. So it was starting to affect them in tangible ways. The other thing is they just built a temple in Brazil, and of course, the Brazilian population is majority black. And I think they realized that, well, who is going to go to this temple?
Yeah.
Because the members there couldn't. And so they realized at that time that it was no longer beneficial to them to have this ban. And so they changed it. So often what is deter what is said to be revelation and progress and all of that in the church is actually very steered by practical considerations. And I think that, the moment that its tax exempt status, for example, is threatened, it will make changes to ensure it keeps that. So
Yeah.
tithing is very important to the church. Mormons pay 10% of their income to the church. And you need to pay that in order to be a member in good standing, which, you can't go to the temple without that. You can't be married in the temple. There's a lot of stuff that is tied to that. So.
Isn't it funny that these religious beliefs have to be dragged kicking and screaming into the 21st century? Well, in this case it wasn't even 21st century, but just in terms of, like, you would think that, the true religion of God would be against racism, would be against slavery, would be against all of these things, yet it's religious people that were like, I mean, not all of them, I mean, I'm sure there was religious people against it too, but what I mean is religious people were able to justify their bigotry by quoting the same books.
Yep.
Right?
No,
And I,
absolutely. And the church is always kicking and screaming is a good way to put it. The supposed prophet, seer, and revelator, why is he always dragging about 20 to 30 years behind the rest of society? I agree with you. If this was the truth, it would not be the way it is, it wouldn't flag behind that way, lag behind, sorry.
And it's also interesting that when you look at these different religions, like you said, a lot of it comes down to, at the end of the day, money and power, right? Like, you said that they actually claim that God sends them revelations even today, like these prophets, they talk to God, God tells them things. So they actually claim that, okay, we got a revelation and God said now we can do this. So they're actually claiming to be speaking to God, which is crazy to me as an ex-Muslim, because no Muslim believes that God talks to anyone anymore, which is kind of a cool thing, because there's a last messenger, right? Muhammad was the last man to receive revelation, so nobody else receives revelation now. All you have is like inspiration from God. Like God can inspire you to do something, but like God doesn't talk to you. God doesn't say, hey, Abdullah, go and do this, or you know what I mean? Like, which is interesting, because I mean, in a way, it's a good thing, because you can't have anyone coming and saying now that, but it's also a bad thing, because now how do you progress, because everything's stuck to what happened in the 7th century, right?
Yeah, it becomes very dogmatic, because you can't, it then becomes unchangeable or seen as unchangeable.
Yeah. It becomes much more difficult to change it, because it's everything goes back to being tethered to what Muhammad said and did in the 7th century. Of course, Muslim scholars have the ways around this, the ways of kind of changing, you know, coming up with ways to reinterpret it, recontextualize it. But I want to ask you one thing before we get back to your story. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you about how is it that the Mormon church and the Mormon beliefs, how is it that they allow, let's say, polygamy, whereas most Christians would say polygamy is not allowed, it has to be one man, one wife. I even know Christians tell me you're not allowed to divorce, so it's permanent, your marriage is final forever and ever. So how is it that like this group of this religious sect is so different? I mean every sect is different, but how do they, like, you know, when I talked to an ex-Jehovah's Witness, they took a verse from the Bible and they said, oh, you can't accept blood donations because of this one verse. Every other Christian is like, no, you can accept blood transfusions. So such a confusion, right?
Yeah. So I think Mormonism is definitely quite different, and not just in that way. It's different from in the way it characterizes God. It teaches that God and Jesus and the Holy Spirit are all three separate physical beings, which is unusual in Christianity. There's a lot of difference, and I think it's interesting, because there's a lot of Christian religions that don't consider Mormons to be Christians.
Yeah.
Which, to be honest, I'm not really on board that train, because I think it's a little bit no true Scotsman fallacy, oh, they're not real Christians. But I understand what they're saying, but certainly when I was a Mormon, I considered myself to be Christian and following Christ. But when it comes to the polygamy, I think that one thing that made a big difference is that, you know, we're talking about frontier. So Mormons, you know, moved from New York state where they were, and they moved to Utah and created their own state, and, you know, eventually join the Union, etc. So they were in their own territory, and they did have problems with other people when they were practicing polygamy, and it's one of the reasons that they were persecuted is because of their practice of polygamy. Maybe rightly so. but they, of course, then when they moved to Utah, they were kind of out of the reach of other people. So I think it had the chance to build up in a way that it wouldn't have. I mean, if someone was doing it today, they wouldn't be isolated enough for people not to know. And yeah. So I think that's one reason that polygamy kind of. But in terms of justifying it, it's not from. They do justify it in the sense that the Bible, particularly the Old Testament, has, you know, prophets practicing polygamy. But the Book of Mormon, for example, says that there should only be one wife. So it's kind of weird the way. I think Joseph Smith just got to a point where he's like, yeah, I just want to sleep with a bunch of women, and this is how I'm going to do it. And it went from there.
It's interesting that Muhammad also has exceptions made just for him. Every Muslim is allowed 4 wives. He's allowed up to 9. Like, he doesn't have a limit. Really, he doesn't have a limit. Stuff like that. It's kind of funny. You made an interesting point. And I think as atheists, you describe yourself as atheist, right?
Yes.
as atheists, I find that, you know, we are more open-minded, or I'm more open-minded about what is considered a Christian or what's considered Muslim. Like, for example, many Muslims will say Ahmadiyyas, which is a sect that's, you know, in Pakistan and, you know, all over the world. They don't believe in exactly the finality of prophethood. They believe there was this guy that came after. Some of them call him a prophet. Some of them say he's a Mahdi. They give him a different title. But anyways, most Sunni Muslims consider them apostates or not Muslims, non-Muslims. Right. But as an atheist, why would I exclude them? Because they call themselves Muslim. They say we are Ahmadi Muslims. Yeah. We're a different type of Muslim. Just like Jehovah's Witnesses call themselves Christians and Mormons call themselves Christians. I think we can be a little bit more open-minded because we're not defining the set so narrowly like they want us to define. And of course, they have theological reasons to do so. They want to kind of exclude these people from salvation. I mean, according to these people that say that Jehovah's Witnesses are not and Mormons are not Christian, they're saying they're going to hell, basically, or they're not going to go to heaven.
Yeah.
So it's just a way of kind of, oh, I'm better than you kind of thing. And, you know, maybe I don't really have a problem with that because, I mean, that's the theology. If the theology inclines them to say that you're not Christian or this person's not Muslim, I don't really have a problem with that. What I do have a problem with is bigotry and treating someone different or, you know, unfairly because of the religious sect. So I don't, like, I know some Ahmadis complain that, oh, this is bigotry that Sunni Muslims are calling us non-Muslim. I personally, like, I talked to a prominent Ahmadi about this, and I told him, I don't think it really matters. Why do you care what they call you? What matters is how they treat you. They should treat you the same as anybody else, that you have the right to,
yeah,
you know what I mean? Like to a job, to your freedom of expression and religion. Of course, they don't have any of that in Pakistan right now. They're treated like really, really badly because, you know, they're considered like blasphemers and whatever, and they're killed, and it's just horrible. I don't even want to go into that. But that's the key, right? The key is we don't care what you call yourself, but you have the right, and I have the right as an atheist or as an agnostic or as a Christian or whatever. We all have the right to be treated decently, no matter what we believe.
Yeah, and I mean, I'd say two things about that. The first is, I agree with you that I don't care how someone in a Christian religion wants to define Christianity. Like, they can, they're very welcome to argue the theology of it, to say, you know, here's why we don't think it's truly Christian. They can do that. But I think that when you're looking at the effects of Christianity on the world, when you're actually trying to say, look, these are the things that religion does, you have to be able to say, well, the reason I'm including these people as Christians is because they do these things in the name of Christianity. They call themselves Christians, and it's part of the broader sort of tapestry of what Christianity looks like. And Christianity is always going to be defined by the people who practice it. So I find a little bit of, it's a bit useless to be like, oh yeah, but you can't talk about that as Christianity, because it's like, well, yeah, I can. Yeah. But if you want to do that within your religion, you want to argue about what true Christianity is, that's fine. Yeah. But the second thing is connected to what you said about it's what people do. I don't care if people believe. I don't want to actively encourage anyone to not believe the things they believe until what they believe hurts other people. And that for me is the absolute key. There's a chap here, he's a pastor, his name's Jared McKenna, and he has done so much good as a Christian pastor to help refugees and asylum seekers. And this is a man who, you know, I don't want to, you know, I'm not going to call anybody perfect, but he lives his religion in a way that just benefits the world. His religion leads him to do good. If everybody was like him, I wouldn't give a damn about.
Yeah.
So with him, he'll sometimes say on Twitter, you know, he might say something that I think doesn't make any sense in terms of theology, but I never, ever go to the trouble of arguing those points with him. because I just don't care, because he's a good person doing good things. And that's how I feel about it generally. Like, I'm only going to rail against your beliefs when you start to do things that I think are hurtful. You know, that's what it's always going to boil down to for me. It's the only reason I ever talk about religion, is because there's harm.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Two things I want to say about that. One is you reminded me of how a lot of Muslims will say ISIS are not Muslim, which I think is pretty funny, because ISIS are shouting from the top of the whatever the buildings, "We are Muslim, we are Muslim, we are Muslim, this is Islam." And the other Muslims were like, you know, like, "I'm not with that guy." No, I have nothing to do with that guy, which they don't. I mean, I'm to be fair, they don't ascribe to that evil ideology the same way. You know, they don't believe. Anyways, the point is that they don't ascribe themselves to the same type of Islam that ISIS has. But to say that ISIS is not Muslims is just ludicrous. It's just ridiculous. And like you said, that is part of the tapestry of what Christianity is. Christianity includes groups like Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormons and all sorts of other groups that maybe, you know, Orthodox Muslim Christians wouldn't want to accept for whatever reasons. But you're right, it is. In terms of what you said about not discouraging people to, you know, with the beliefs, I think the problem or the issue is that I agree with you, and I do think that that's the case. But where do we draw the line? Because I do think that as a net whole, religion is bad for the world. I don't mean all religion, but let's say in particular, let's say I'm talking about my form of religion, Islam. And I do think that it's a net loss for the world overall, even though it does encourage a lot of good things like this fasting. And I don't like the way that the Islamic fast is, because there's reasons for that. But let's just say there is some good in there. There's some giving charity and whatever. But I feel like on the whole, we can do better as human beings with just humanism. And I know you're a big proponent of humanism. But of course, some people without religion, they would be bad people, right? I mean, unfortunately, that's just the situation in the world. That there are people out there that they're like, religion is what stops me from like hurting others. And I wonder if really, truly they mean that. Maybe they wouldn't actually be bad people without religion. I don't know. Like, I feel like I'm the same. Like my kids told me, "You're the same person," even after I left Islam. They're like, "Yeah, you're still the same guy. Yeah. You're still the same dad." I'm like, "Yeah, I'm still the same guy. I just, you know."
I remember Ricky Gervais in an interview, someone said to him, you know, "Well, if you don't believe in God, what stops you from just going out and, you know, raping and murdering as much as you want to?" And he said, "I do." And they said, "What do you mean?" He said, I rape and murder as much as I want to, which is not at all. You know, it's like, why would I do those things? You know, like if your religion is the only thing stopping you from behaving that way, you have some issues.
So as much as I'm enjoying this conversation and the way it's going, let's finish your story. I apologize for getting into all of these different kind of side tangents.
Oh, no, it's fine.
So let's continue where you were at. So how did you end up leaving it, and like, what was that like?
Yeah. So I think, and remember I was saying to you about keeping people really busy is a good way to keep them believing and in the religion. I think a really pivotal thing that happened was I took a job in Japan, and I was there for 3 years. And I learned Japanese, but I was never fluent enough that it was easy for me to have a church calling. So even though I was still a practicing Mormon, for 3 years, I wasn't spending, you know, my time preparing lessons and, you know, reading things, you know, to do this. And I think that was really crucial, because it gave me a kind of a mental distance from having those ideas again, 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 every day, sort of reinforced in my mind. And Mormons are, in my experience, they're very good at self-censoring. So if you come across something that seems to imply that the church is bad in some way, or that Joseph Smith was a con man, which he was, they're very, very quick. And I did this myself to just push it away, you know, like, oh, that's anti-Mormon, you know, and that response is that knee-jerk response is conditioned into you. So when I had this kind of break from these constant messages, I think that that was what made it possible for me to really consider the information with a bit more objectivity. So after those 3 years, I came back to Australia and actually just stumbled across someone on the internet who was saying that they had to tell their spouse that they didn't believe anymore in the church, and they were really worried that she was going to leave them, and that happens. And I, being the arrogant believer that I was, I asked them what the problem was because I thought I might be able to help them clear it up, and they told me. They sort of sent me a link to some information about a book of scripture that Mormons consider it scripture, called the Book of Abraham. And really, really briefly, there was an Egyptian papyri, a set of papyri that were found. Nobody could read hieroglyphics at the time. Joseph Smith claimed it was the Book of Abraham, written by Abraham, and he created this translation of this book, and it became Mormon scripture. Unfortunately for him, the Rosetta Stone was finally, the hieroglyphics on that were finally translated, and people became able to read it, and it's completely fraudulent. Right? These are funerary documents. They're very common. You know, any Egyptologist has seen dozens of these things. And so his translation was proven.
Oh, I think there's been a connection problem with Debbie. Can you guys in the comments just let me know if you just noticed the chat? I mean, I still seem to be here. Can you guys still see me? And if not, let me know. I guess you won't. Hello, hello. And can someone please comment if you can still hear me talking? It looks like Debbie is frozen. And it looks like I'm still live. I'm just going to double check. Okay, good. So I'm still here. Okay. All right, Debbie's back. I see she's back. Okay, there we go. Hi, Debbie. Looks like you got
Hi.
disconnected for a second.
Yeah, no idea what happened, but I
Yeah,
just
no
reconnected.
worries. I got panicked because not panicked, but I was worried because last time my internet died in the middle of a stream and it was such a disaster because I
Oh
tried to reconnect and I ended the stream by mistake.
no.
Oh my God. Anyways, so you were saying, yeah, so they figured out this was a fraud. I mean, that's pretty funny to me because I think like anyone that knows anything about translation would have been able to tell that like the symbols are not matching up with what the guy was claiming. You know
Yeah.
what I mean? Like
He
he would
was
have to.
very creative about it, but yeah, no. Yeah, it
Yeah.
was just yeah. But what was important about this experience for me was there was no way to justify it, to explain it away. Like when I looked at the evidence, I had to know he had lied. It was just so obvious. And so
And this was Joseph
that
Smith, right?
then was a catalyst for me to say, okay, I actually need to question all of his claims. Like, I need to question the Book of Mormon and the authority of the church and the idea of his first vision, the vision that he had with God and Jesus. Like, and then it all crumbled. Like, you know, the more I found out, the more it just crumbled away. It didn't stand up to scrutiny. And yeah, and that was kind of the end for me. And I left the church, probably about 6 months after that. And then probably another 6 months later, the Proposition 8, the church had a lot of involvement in Proposition 8 in California to try and make same-sex marriage illegal there. And that's when I decided I really didn't want to be associated with the church at all, and I resigned my membership. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Just to clarify, it was Joseph Smith that claimed that that document was Abraham's text. Okay, so he actually was caught in a lie.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And how do other Mormons parse that information? Are they not aware of this information? Are they? How do they deal with this?
Yeah, there's a bit of a spectrum there. So there's people who just are not aware that that it's been shown to be a fraud. There are people who, so there's a catalyst theory where, and this is just an apologist theory that is ridiculous, but in order to keep believing that it's scripture, some people argue that the Egyptian papyri were not actually important. They were just a catalyst for him to produce this book of scripture, which is ridiculous because, and the church's official take on this is that it was a direct translation. So, you know, that's just a way to explain around it. But I find a lot of Mormons, I think, are just not aware of it. They've never come across the information. So, yeah.
I guess cognitive dissonance is it's a common experience, a common theme when it comes to religious beliefs, because at the end of the day, religion is not, it's not meant to be based on rationality per se, right? It's more like, you know, I'm believing in these things because I have faith. And so, you know, it's, we are able to, you know, the funny thing is we've evolved this ability to have cognitive dissonance. We're able to hold two contradictory pieces of information in the mind. But sometimes, you know, we become aware of this and it causes doubt. And then we follow, we look into the doubt. So I'm really happy to hear that, you know, in your case, when you heard about this, you were able to deal with it. I know Malcolm X, when he actually exposed Elijah Muhammad as being this womanizer that was, he had all these teenage brides, not brides, like women he slept with, and he wasn't even giving them child support or whatever, and he was shocked by this realization. He thought this is the final nail in the coffin. If I actually tell people this, they will just leave him. But he didn't realize like how religious brainwashing or whatever you want to call it works. Like when he actually told people, instead of getting angry at Elijah Muhammad, they got angry at him. And they're like,
yeah.
You know what I mean? And he became the enemy. And eventually he was killed because of this, I believe, because he exposed, you know, his former. And, you know, people said, oh, you're biting the hand that fed you. This guy took care of you. He raised you. He took, I mean, not raised you, but like he basically raised you from, took you out of jail or whatever. And a lot of them, they kind of like, you know, like they blocked it out of their mind. They're like, yeah, well, he's a man too. And, you know, he has his sins, yeah. But you know, God will forgive. Like he went from this.
So familiar.
It's fun.
It's so much overlap.
Isn't it? Like, it's just a human experience, isn't it? It's like going from infallible prophet to like this man that has sins, but still following him as if God had spoke to him. Yeah, indeed. So yeah, unfortunately, I don't know. That is the way we humans are. We're able to kind of do two things at once, and in that way we were able to kind of hold on to these ideas and so someone was asking, because I did say I would take a few questions before we go, how do ex-Mormons treat, how do Mormons treat you now? I think he said ex-Mormons, but I think he meant how do Mormons treat you now if you tell them you're not Mormon anymore.
There's probably two really common situations. So Mormons don't officially shun, okay? Not like Jehovah's Witness. They that's an official
process,
tenet of their church, right? Mormons don't officially shun, but they do socially. So, and sometimes it's because they actually think you're. So the church has a bit of a narrative when it comes to ex-Mormons that, you know, they don't have light in them. There's, you know, they've gone to evil ways. They leave because they want to sin. They never really had a testimony. You know, I mean, I'm sure you've heard.
This is sounding so familiar. Like,
yeah. Because, you know, you can't just leave because it's not true. It always has to be for some other reason. And so there's a narrative there that is intended to discredit ex-Mormons. So when, you know, when you say things to them, it's like, well, why would I believe anything you say? I mean, you've left, you're an apostate. Like, and it's an interesting divide for me, because if you stop going to church, but you don't say that you don't believe anymore, Mormons will work day and night to be kind to you, to be nice, to try to bring you back to church. But when you leave, when you actually say, I'm an ex-Mormon, I don't believe, I've resigned my membership, etc., the whole thing can change. And of course I'm making a generalization. Of course there are people who don't behave that way, and I appreciate those people. But there are definitely people who just never talk to me again. People I was quite friendly with, who, you know, I'd invite them to something and they'd just always be busy. Like, they just cut me off. One of my closest friends, who was very lovely, who stayed friends with me, I've been friends with them for, gosh, 30 years, and I love them all dearly. It took her 3 years to ask me why I left. Like, so we just never talked about it. Now, I understand her situation. I understand what it's like to be a believing Mormon and have these kinds of things challenge your identity and challenge who you are. So when you have friends who have a shared belief with you, when they leave the belief, it can be very confronting to your own identity. Like, you feel as though they're rejecting you, even when they're absolutely not. And she said to me just the other day, I didn't want to know why you'd left. I wasn't ready to know. And I understand that. I really do. But it's just really telling. So sometimes there's people who are really hostile. And then there are people who just don't know how to deal with the fact that you've left. They don't know what to do with it. And the easiest way to deal with it is to just pretend you don't exist anymore. So yeah, there's a bit of a range there, but I mean, I was super lucky because my family wasn't really active apart from my mum. My dad, for example, he was not really very upset about the fact that I'd left the church. He was devastated a little bit later on when I told him I had actually become an atheist. That was very hard for him to deal with. My sister stopped going to church when she was a teenager, so actually she and I are closer since I left the church. My mum was just a really good person. and when I explained to her that, I had some issues with Joseph Smith, I was going to leave, she literally, the first thing she said to me was, I will support whatever decision that you make, which I can tell you there are plenty of people who don't have that experience, who their family either disowns them, they will never, ever be happy for them unless they're back in church. I know someone who he left the church when he came out as gay, and his parents would not allow him to talk to or visit his siblings unless he promised never to talk about leaving the church or being gay. So his younger siblings didn't really know that he didn't believe anymore. And that was the condition on which he could visit his parents' home. Wow. I know people who've lost custody of their kids, but they live in Utah where, you know, the church has a very strong influence. That mm-hmm. wouldn't necessarily happen in Australia, for example.
Okay.
So, yeah, there can be some really, really serious consequences. I feel very fortunate because I might have lost friends and I might have lost people who probably really weren't friends. I kept a lot. I kept some good friends. The ones that mattered didn't abandon me. And actually, some of them have now left as well. So,
That's awesome.
yeah.
That's great to hear. I'm glad that you're doing well inside. I mean, you can kind of tell from like the way you express yourself and the way you're candid. You can tell from your candor that you're doing fine. I mean, you can tell you're not like angry about this. You're cool. I mean, there's definitely like an angry atheist phase that some of us go through, but you're
Oh, and I
obviously
think,
not.
yeah.
So we are getting at to sorry, we're getting to an hour now, and I know you have to get going. There is more questions, but I think we've covered a lot.
Yeah.
And I did pin, so just for those of you who don't know, Debbie is on TikTok. She has wonderful little 1 minute, what do you call them? TikToks? I don't know what they're called. Posts.
Yeah.
Posts on
TikTok
TikTok.
videos, yeah.
Yeah, so do check it out on there. I've pinned the post. It's in the description as well. Debbie, do you have any final words you'd want to say about anything?
I guess I'd really like to agree with what you just said. Life after Mormonism is good. And I say that because I don't know if anyone who's watching this is Mormon, or that whether Mormons will stumble across this. It can be very, and I guess it applies actually to leaving any high demand religion. It can be scary. You don't know what it's going to be like after you leave. You feel like you're losing your community. In some cases, people still have this fear that, maybe they're going to go to hell. It can take a long time to get rid of those ideas and process all of that. But you get there. It's like how I feel about life now is so different. And I'm actually really, I'm so glad. I'm just so glad that I've left Mormonism and religion in general behind. It's been a very good change.
That's the best way to end this chat. And so to everyone that's here today, I didn't get a chance to plug the channel. Please do click on join if you'd like to financially support the channel. There's also Patreon available as well. Thank you, Debbie. That was a wonderful conversation, and we'd love to
Thanks
have
to you
you on
too.
again sometime. It was great, all the way from Australia. And yeah, I guess I'll see you on TikTok. And to everyone else, have a good day or good night, wherever you are.
Yeah.
And
And
we'll.
I'll say too, I can't actually see the comments because I don't know, it's not showing up on the iPad, but if someone did have specific questions, feel free to come over to the TikTok and ask them because I'm happy to make a video answering those questions. So
Yeah, there were a couple of questions. Yeah, so if you guys want to keep engaging, I mean, that's the best way to do it. Join
sure.
us on TikTok. Join us both and do a duet or make a stitch or whatever they call it. All this, I had to learn all this new fancy smancy
Yeah.
terminology. But yeah, it's fun. It's a fun platform. We didn't get to talk about that, but yeah, it is a fun platform because you get to have these little.
Yeah.
It forces you to kind of limit what you're saying to 1 minute, unless you're in the VIP special VIP club like me. I get 3 minutes early access, whatever beta or
You were
whatever it is.
lucky.
But yeah, 1 minute, it can be tough, but you have to kind of think about, sometimes you have to like record it multiple times, right, to get it perfect.
Yeah. I'm not, I'm getting better at being brief.
Exactly. Okay, everyone. So take care, and we'll see you again. I don't have another live stream planned just yet, but hopefully within the next week or so, I will do something. So stay safe, everyone, and see you again later. Bye.
There. Thank you.